What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey there, welcome again to Call to Communion for this Friday afternoon. Delighted to have you with us. Today we're not going to be taking your phone calls. We're doing a special mailbag edition of the program. Going to answer a whole bunch of emails we've received over the past couple of weeks. May even have a couple of listener comment line calls that have come in overnight. So today it is going to be our producer, Pedro Quiles, me, Tom Price, and Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Going to lead off with an interesting call that came in overnight on the EWTN listener comment line.
Hi, this is Matt, and the city I reside in is Bowie, Maryland. My question is, for the first roughly 1,500 years of the church, there were many heresies and schisms that came and they went, the Gnostics, the Arians. Some of them were very powerful, influential at certain points, but eventually they fizzled out and died. Why, in your opinion, did not the same thing happen to Protestantism? What accounts for its sticking power? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I think there are a couple of factors. One, I would like to point out that Gnosticism and Pelagianism have not gone away. They're still around.
Yeah.
And they're actually powerful cultural influences that, they may not be an organized movement, like the First Gnostic Church of Tuscaloosa or something, right? But the spirit of Gnosticism is alive and well in conspiratorial thinking and over-intellectualized religion and political ideology and sometimes just in straight-up Gnostic belief and practice. I mean, there are contemporary Gnostic proponents and students of Gnosticism that think it's kind of avant-garde and cool, and the Gnostic Gospels being published, in New York Times bestseller lists and this sort of thing. So I think it's actually quite active in the world today. And Pelagianism is is just sort of a natural human inclination towards a style of religious practice that, even if there's not an organized movement called, again, the Pelagian Church of West Lafayette, Pope Francis wrote an apostolic exhortation or encyclical, I forget which, about both of these things, and said they pervade Christian life in the world. We have to be continually alert to their dangers. But it is true that there were a lot of ancient heresies that were actively suppressed. Now, to say that they just went away, again, a little bit deceptive. So, take the heresy of Nestorianism, for example. Well, it went away within the geographical boundaries of the Roman Empire because the Byzantine Empire suppressed it by arms. I mean, like, it was illegal, right, to be a... But they didn't stop... There didn't stop being Nestorians. They just all went to Persia. and the Nestorian Church, or the Assyrian Church of the East, continues to exist into the world to this day, and it's had a continuous existence ever since the Council of Ephesus in the mid 5th century, right? And one church's heresy is another church's legitimate dissent, and so you'll find other versions of these ancient Christian heresies actually with continuity down through the centuries, although their geographic influence is limited and so forth. But what led to the staying power of Protestantism? I think there's several factors. So one, we already mentioned the role that the Roman Empire played, the Byzantine Empire, in suppressing the official recognition of heretical movements.
Mm-hmm.
It was conspicuous that in the early Reformation, you had magisterial support for the early Reformation. You had many of the princes in Germany got behind it. Several of the Swiss cantons became openly Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
None more significant, of course, than Geneva. That was Calvinist. It was Protestant, and then it became officially Calvinist. Calvinism became the official dogma of the city. You could actually go to jail, be punished civilly for disagreeing publicly with Calvin's institutes. You didn't have the King of France did not become Protestant, but 17th century French aristocrats did, which ultimately precipitated the wars of religion. But you had areas within France, almost states within states, cities that were governmentally Protestant, and they basically were almost in opposition to the crown. It ultimately did lead to civil war. England, of course, did leave the fold. Henry VIII, King of England, imposed Protestantism on, and especially under Elizabeth. I mean, the Book of Common Prayer became the normative, mandated model for religious practice. And if you dissented from it, you could face severe consequences, including death by torture. The Low Countries did the same thing. The Holland was usually a bastion of religious tolerance, but it was officially Reformed Protestant. And areas of Germany as well, you already mentioned that. And so, I mean, the places where Protestantism thrived typically were those places where it had some form of aristocratic or municipal or royal support, and that's a major factor. Another major difference was the invention of the printing press. So this was a serious engine of disseminating Protestant ideas, and Protestantism wasn't just disseminated by the printing press. The technology itself became part of the appeal, in that the printing press was the Silicon Valley of the 16th century. It was the avant-garde technology, and you actually find that people that work as printers, journeymen, were more likely to adopt Reformation ideas because they enhanced their elevated sense of social location, right? And there's a lot of social history about this kind of thing. You can sort of track Protestantism across different career paths, and some vocations were more likely to become Protestant than others as those particular vocations were correlated with exactly this dynamic of a elevated sense of personal importance vis-a-vis the rest of the culture. Think about, you know, like computer programmers of Silicon Valley, how they probably feel like they're sort of at the cutting edge of things. And those kinds of areas of culture are often not only at the cutting edge of technology, but they put themselves at the cutting edge of other things as well, you know.
Sure.
There was a major shift in cultural mentality that was swept Protestant and Catholic countries. The Annales school in French sociology and French historiography goes into this at great length. It's the whole subject of their field of study. And the discovery of the individual, right, is something that begins in the High Middle Ages, but really comes into the fore in the Renaissance and early 16th century. And Protestantism spoke to that by its appeal to the priesthood of all believers and direct access to the Bible, what Alistair McGrath calls, sort of riffing on Daniel Dennett, Protestantism's dangerous idea, riffing on Dennett's Darwinism's dangerous idea. So we could go into this at greater depth, but I think I've given you a taste.
Well, you certainly have. Thanks so much for that phone call from our listener comment line. Back in a moment with lots more Call to Communion. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Not taking your phone calls today. We're going to take care of a whole bunch of emails we've received over the last couple of weeks on this special mailbag program. So sit back and enjoy it. Coming up this weekend, of course, the fourth Sunday of Lent, and our great program, Lenten Reflections, will be talking about the great gifts of baptism with Father Albert Robertson. He is assistant chaplain at Cambridge University, talking about the healing of the man born blind as a metaphor for baptism, giving gifts of healing, reconciliation, and illumination. Fascinating program, always worth the listen. Sunday morning, 6 a.m. Eastern, Sunday evening, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, only on EWTN Radio. All right, let's get into some of these emails, if you would, David. We're going to begin with this one from Marguerite. What does it mean in the Bible when it says that Elijah has come in the person of John the Baptist? This sounds like reincarnation to me.
Oh, yeah, I really appreciate the question. It's definitely not reincarnation. It's the claim that he came in the power and spirit of Elijah and is the fulfillment of Malachi's prophecy that before the day of the Lord he would send the prophet Elijah. You know, when Elijah went up to heaven, when he was taken up in the fiery chariot, his servant Elisha said, "Would you leave me with a double portion of your spirit?" And he does so, which basically means, will you confer on me your prophetic position and authority?
Uh-huh.
And he does so. And so John the Baptist is in a kind of a patrilineal line, if you will, back to Elijah, and represents the fulfillment of that well of that prophecy.
Okay. Thanks so much for that question, Marguerite. Here's one now from Timothy. Dr. Anders, can you explain the notion of Jansenism and why the Catholic Church ultimately felt compelled to push back against it?
Yeah. So Cornelius Jansen was a Dutch theologian who was a big fan of St. Augustine of Hippo, and he wrote a book called The Augustinus that was an interpretation of Augustine's theology that stressed our depravity, our corruption in sin, and our inability to do anything good, and in ways that struck many contemporary Catholics as similar to Calvinism. Also, like Calvinism, he held to a doctrine of limited atonement, meaning that Christ did not die for the whole world, but only for the elect, and a moral rigorism, which might strike you as odd and incongruous with a doctrine of total depravity, but a moral rigorism that was intended to make people very hesitant about receiving the sacrament of Holy Communion and to be sort of hyper-vigilant in examining their consciences and the state of their souls. And so a deep fixation on one's interior sinfulness to an excessive degree and kind of an elitism that viewed the rest of the Catholic world as unacceptably lax, both in its doctrine and in its moral practice. And so that sense of elitism made it, again, to many of its contemporaries, appear sectarian. And in fact, it probably was sectarian, that the Jansenists considered their mortal enemies to be the Jesuits. Pascal, the great philosopher and mathematician, who was a Jansenist, wrote a set of satirical letters parodying Jesuit theology and spirituality.
Really?
And they're regarded as some of the greatest pieces of satirical and polemical literature ever written, right?
Okay.
They really do a wonderful job of lampooning the Jesuits. There was a large Jansenist culture in France that became wrapped up in many other things. So there was a cemetery where a famous Jansenist theologian had died and been buried. And Jansenist devotees would go and venerate his relics, which is a very Catholic thing to do. But when they did so, they began to manifest bizarre charismatic behaviors, convulsions and ecstasies and allegations of prophecy and so
really?
Forth. Yes, the convulsionists, they were called. And it became kind of this is another kind of weird oddity. How did all these things fit together? But it became a kind of like, lowbrow charismatic revival, but with deeply sort of anti-clerical, anti-hierarchical motifs. And so it was suppressed by the hierarchy. The tendency to kind of view the rest of the Catholic world as corrupt carried over into its view of the monarchy, which was, very mainstream Catholic, if you will. And so it was also implicated in the heresy of conciliarism, which was a kind of diminishment of papal authority in view of church councils. And so the French bishops regarded the whole thing, and the King of France in particular, as a threat to royal authority, which it probably was. Mm-hmm. Dale Van Clay, who's a historian of 18th century France, has a book called The Religious Origins of the French Revolution that argues that Jansenism was a major influence on fomenting anti-royalist sentiment that would ultimately bear fruit in the French Revolution.
Wow.
In 1789, which is a sort of a radical thesis, because most people see that as a direct outgrowth of a secular enlightenment, not a uber right-wing reactionary religious movement, but nevertheless, uh-huh. That's the dynamic. And so the King of France put a lot of pressure on the Pope to condemn Jansenism, probably because it thought he served its royal interests, but it also served the church's interests. And so Jansenism was suppressed. It was ruled a heresy. And the Jansenists all affirmed the Pope's teaching and denied that they held any of the positions that were condemned. And a lot of fine logic chopping went back and forth between different theological parties trying to define what, in fact, Jansenism was or wasn't and who did or did not actually hold it.
Wow.
Jansen himself was never condemned by the church and died, a faithful son of the church. So this is all post-Cornelius Jansen. It was a movement that sprang up in his name after the fact. But today you'll hear contemporary Catholics throwing around accusations of Jansenism, and it's become, you know, kind of a meaningless term, because it's, you know, any time one Catholic thinks that another Catholic is being too rigorous or reactionary mm-hmm. in their religion, they'll say, well, they're Jansenists, and they may or may not be Jansenists. But we actually had a real live Jansenist call this show once. I don't know if you remember. It's been several years.
Yeah.
But we had a fellow call in, and he was actually a card-carrying Jansenist. And I was like, I am so happy to talk to you. I've never met a card-carrying Jansenist. My graduate school advisor during my master's thesis, not my PhD, was an evangelical historian named John Woodbridge. And his academic specialty was 18th century France. And so he knew all about Jansenists, and he was all up into this stuff with big time. And he told us one time there was a Jansenist library someplace in France, I forget where, you know, for their archives. And he wanted to know if he could have access to it. He told us this story in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told that, you know, he had to have somebody vouch for him because they wouldn't let him in if he was a Jesuit.
Wow.
And so he goes to the library, and whoever the librarian is opens the door before his friend, who's going to vouch for him, gets there, takes one look at him and lets it in. And he says to his friend, well, I thought you said they had the vouch for him. Oh, they took one look at you and knew you weren't a Jesuit. Right? And they let him in. So it's, believe it or not, there's still, like, you know, some whiffs of this floating around.
Amazing.
So it's a fruitful subject for historical study. And again, if you want to read about its influence on the French Revolution, take a look at Dale Van Clay's book.
Bit of a tangled web.
It's a bit of a tangled web.
Man,
yeah.
Oh man, wow. Timothy, thanks so much for your fascinating question. I learned a few things today. It is called a communion here on EWTN. I learn something every day, actually. Here's a question now from Richard, who says, Dr. Anders, I have a question regarding receiving my first communion. I never received as a child, and when I was in the Navy, I went to confession and then received communion. I had been attending Mass when available, but did not receive communion. I was told if I went to confession, this would be okay. I am a practicing Catholic. I have received my confirmation, but this question always was in the back of my mind. I am 72 now. All this happened in the early 1970s. Thank you and God bless. Richard.
Okay, Richard, thanks. So you have been baptized. You have received communion. You have been confirmed. You have received all of the sacraments of initiation. You're good. You really are a Catholic. Okay? Now, if your reception of these sacraments was in a rather haphazard and irregular way, not to worry, not your fault.
Good. Okay. Well, there you go. Richard, thanks so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of the program today here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Here's one now from Jeffrey, who says, thanks for all you do. I tune into your show and also Dr. Ray just about every day. Well, there's a 1-2 punch.
There you
go. Dr. Ray and Dr. David. He says, I'm struggling to understand a reading from Daniel. I prayed to...
Me too.
He says, the reading is, I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O God, O Lord, the great and terrible God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Please help me to better understand this.
All right. So I'm struggling a little bit to know why this is obscure to you. Is it that he describes God as terrible? Is it because he is the God who keeps covenant with those that are faithful, but not other people? Got any ideas, Tom? What's your intuition?
Hard to say. It really is hard to say.
Well, let me say that quote again.
Yep. All right.
Let me have a peek at
that. Here you go.
All right. Oh, God, the great and terrible God who keeps covenant and steadfast loves with those who keep his commandments. Okay, well, the only thing I could find in here that would be obscure, maybe strange, would be the description of God as terrible. Have you read the Old Testament recently, right? There's some serious bloodletting, all right, that God indicates. I mean, I was actually just reading the book of Zephaniah recently, and I don't have the passage right in front of me, but Zephaniah begins with God saying, more or less, guys, I'm going to blow you all the heck away, right? This is the end of you. I'm coming for you, bud. I'm coming. And it sounds all pretty terrifying and horrible, right? And for that matter, even Jesus is kind of scary in this regard when he says, woe to you, Bethsaida and Chorazin. Mm-hmm. If the miracles done in before you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented and not you. So it'll be worse for you than it was for them on the day of judgment. Well, it was pretty bad for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I haven't had hail and fiery hail and brimstone rained on my house recently, but it's going to be worse than that, right? This is what Jesus says. So, I mean, there are definitely descriptions of God's wrath in Scripture that could be described as terrible.
Well, there you go. Thanks so much for that email. Here's one now from John who says, Dr. Anders, does the Catholic Church have a document that clearly states or summarizes what we consider to be essential for salvation? And if not, why? Would this be an infallible teaching? Protestants are often criticized that they can't agree on essentials, but do we have essentials so clearly defined?
Oh, yeah.
Thanks,
absolutely.
John.
Hands down, all over the place. I mean, it's just written in large, bold letters throughout the entire history of Catholic tradition, ordinary and extraordinary magisterium. I mean, in spades. And it's stated very plainly in St. Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians, chapter 13. He says, you have all this other stuff? Not worth a dime if you don't have charity. Charity is the whole show. Charity is the whole kit and caboodle. It's the whole ball of wax. And at the end of the day, it is love that fulfills all the commandments of God. Romans 13:8. Love of God, love of neighbor satisfies the entire law. Everything else in the Catholic tradition, everything else in the Catholic tradition is understood to be a means to that end.
Okay.
Everything else. And St. Augustine says that explicitly. He says the entire dispensation of our faith is instrumental, is a means to an end. He says regarded as a road or a chariot. Its purpose is to get you from A to B. The important thing is that you land at B, and B is the love of God and neighbor. That's the whole show. That's what you need. Council of Trent, Session 6, Chapter 16, talking about the doctrine of grace, says that the one who has sanctifying grace, we should regard, even the baby that comes out of the baptismal font, we should regard as having fulfilled the commands of God in view of the fact that God's, again, love has been poured into his heart or her heart.
Okay. John, thanks so much for your email. We're doing a special mailbag edition of the program here on this Friday afternoon on EWTN. This one now from Tony, who says, how do we obey the commandment to honor the Sabbath when the Sabbath is something that doesn't apply to us Gentile Christians?
Yeah, so the church is pretty clear about this. The most the way that that commandment is interpreted in Catholic life is that we fulfill our Sunday obligation to go to Mass and worship the Lord in commemoration of his death and resurrection. And then to set that side, that day aside, the first day of the week, as a day for a recollection, for prayer, for relaxation, time with family and reconnecting with nature and things like that, but especially the sacrifice of the Mass.
Very good. And one more as we're heading into break. This is from Jerry. Can you please comment on why John Duns Scotus was beatified by Pope John Paul II? And does his position on many philosophical and theological points, especially voluntarism, put him at odds with the Catholic Church?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So Duns Scotus was beatified because the evidence was for his heroic charity and the witness of at least one miracle, right? That's the criteria for beatification.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, his biography is not that extensive. I think the Pope also probably wanted to elevate Scotus in importance because of Scotus's unique role in promoting the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, which has been, of course, very important in modern Catholic life, and particularly to modern popes, and wanting to promote veneration of Our Lady and Marian devotion. Mm-hmm. It would be sensible to highlight those people in the tradition that have done the most to, in fact, ensure that outcome, right? And Duns Scotus being critical in that regard. Scotism is an acceptable legal position that one can take in Catholic theology. It's not at odds with Catholicism. It is at odds with Thomism.
Okay.
So you can't be a consistent Scotist and be a consistent Thomist, but you're not required to be one or the other.
Jerry, thanks so much for your email. Lots more straight ahead on this mailbag edition of Call to Communion on EWTN. Welcome back. It is Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. If you're just joining us, We're doing a special mailbag edition of the program today, so not taking your phone calls, but we've got some great emails to tackle over the next next 30 minutes or so. Here's one from Datum, D-A-T-U-M. Interesting name, probably a pseudonym there. But this person says, I am bothered by the prolonged injustice throughout most of Christian history regarding the haves and the have-nots. Slavery and serfs were treated as animals, while a small, very powerful group was decadent and frivolous. All this in nations that proclaimed Catholicism. How could the church have been silent for 17 centuries? Why did it take atheists, such as Voltaire, to bring on the Enlightenment? And how can I accept that Christ or the Holy Spirit was guiding the church when this injustice was allowed to continue for so long? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I'd like to know how many Roman philosophers condemned inequality in ancient Roman civilization? None. In fact, they profoundly justified it. How many Hellenistic philosophers, or kings for that matter? None, again. Zoroastrians, Hindus, you pick your religious tradition. How about Genghis Khan? Was he out there fighting for the rights of the poor and elevating the lowly and lifting up the downtrodden? I think not. So why do you think this is wrong? Where do you get the idea that this is wrong? Most civilizations throughout most of history have regarded inequality as fundamentally right, because, after all, it's quite natural. I mean, in the sense of being biological, you know, if you look at primate society, pre-human primate society, primatologists like Franz De Waal have made this point emphatically, right? That you look at chimpanzee culture, for example, and it's tremendously hierarchical, and it is might makes right, buddy. I mean, the guy at the top of the totem pole will beat your snout in if you don't do what he says. You know, I mean, this is how civilizations have been organized from at least the dawn of agriculture, right? And even in the more egalitarian hunter-gatherer cultures, there's still, you know, a fair amount of garden variety oppression, particularly in the form of patriarchy and, you know, women being disfigured and straighted around like property and that sort of thing. So human inequality is really the norm throughout all civilization. And it to raise any kind of objection to that is absolutely the minority position, even though it may be the majority today. What shifted in culture? And I contend it was not the Enlightenment, right? It was, in fact, the advent of Christianity and the explicit teaching of Jesus that the poor and the downtrodden and so forth should be elevated and lifted up. Now, Christ's teaching, of course, has roots in the Hebrew Bible. Now, the Hebrew Bible itself is the product of a downtrodden and persecuted people. And the Hebrew Bible in its present form was finally coalesced after the period of the exile, when the Hebrews were in fact a subjugated people. Mm-hmm. And so the value system of God is going to lift up the lowly, right, is embedded in the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it's made the key point in Christianity by Christ himself. That's sort of the difference between Christ and the Hebrew prophets, is Jesus makes this pretty much the whole show. His whole religious revolution is about what you do to prepare for the kingdom of God is distinctly ethical. Whereas you'll find some of the prophets will still emphasize, well, you know, proper temple ritual and things like that are necessary. Jesus just dispenses with that, says, tear down the temple, I'll rebuild it. What matters is the way you treat the poor, right? And that absolutely does get absorbed into Christian consciousness. And so care for the poor, social justice, becomes intrinsic to Catholic preaching, and especially to religious life, religious practice. So if you, I would challenge you, for example, to read the social justice message. And there's a book by this title, Social Justice in the Theology or the Writings of St. Basil the Great. Basil, Chrysostom, Nazianzus, Gregory of Nyssa, the great hierarchs of the Eastern Christianity, preach this message without ceasing. And it's embedded into their monastic rules, into their way of life. in Benedictine monasticism, which of course is the Western counterpart, receiving the stranger, right, and the sojourner and so forth is endemic. So the institution of public health care, hospitals, care for the sick, this becomes the providence of Catholic religious orders in the Middle Ages. And is who can forget the specter of Francis of Assisi throwing himself into the arms of lepers and kissing their wounds and binding them up and so forth. And so the valorization of the poor and advocating on their behalf and being directly involved in ministry to them is part of the Catholic tradition from the beginning. St. Vincent de Paul, you've heard of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Here's a guy who was captured by Barbary pirates and sold into slavery in North Africa, converts the guy that bought him. Then they escape in the dead of night back to France. He sets up, his society and carries out care for the poor. I mean, so many religious orders have done this throughout Christian history. What did not happen necessarily is that that ethical impulse that was constantly preached, constantly reinforced in Catholic medieval theology and practice, didn't necessarily affect the theology of government or law, right? I mean, it remained at the level of religious practice, of ethical aspiration, reform movements and so forth. Uh-huh. But you don't have political revolution in the name of social equality. You do actually, but it's on a kind of a low scale. And so arguably, and this is the position that I take, I mean, the Enlightenment is not a purely secular movement. I mean, these guys are intellectuals. They are philosophers. They're rationalistic. But they're completely and thoroughly Christianized in their culture. And, they weren't afraid to step back and make fun of the hypocrisy of Catholic civilization and essentially call the Western world to be truer to its own values. In very much the way that Martin Luther King Jr., who was, of course, a Christian, he was a Baptist pastor, understood that the way to end segregation in the very segregated and very Christian South was to appeal to the consciences of his oppressors. And it was not an easy sell, right, for the people who were promoting civil rights. Yeah. He had to work hard to promote nonviolent resistance, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and at great personal cost, not only his assassination, but, of course, all the sit-ins that led to the beatings and the dogs and the jail time and all of that. Mm-hmm. But it worked, right? I mean, because the conscience of the nation was awakened, and they said, we understand intrinsically that this is wrong. We're not living true to our convictions. My mm-hmm. point is, why do you have those convictions? It's because at some level you believe in the concept of equality or human dignity. You don't know that empirically. No empirical evaluation of human individuals or society would lead you to the belief that they're equal. I mean, they're clearly not equal when it comes to their natural endowments. Some are taller, some are stronger, some are smarter. Why not let them dominate? That's what the Greeks did. That's what the Romans did. The only reason you think that's wrong is because you've been influenced by Christianity that says the poor, then the weak, and the vulnerable deserve to be lifted up, right? And that was foolishness to the Romans. They thought if you were poor and weak, you deserve to be conquered, right? But that Christianity doesn't have that. And a materialist, atheist, anti-religious polemicist like Richard Dawkins, who is absolutely no lover of religious practice, has come out and said that he considers himself to be, a God-hating, materialistic atheist who wants to be a cultural Christian. Because he recognizes that, at the very least, Christianity is the scaffolding on which the secular values of human rights were established. And if you kick the scaffolding all the way out, well, the superstructure doesn't stand on its own.
And, it is really good to be reminded of these kind of formative things that go back many centuries.
So Tom Woods, the historian, has a great little book called How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization.
That's great.
That you might take a peek at.
Appreciate that. Thanks so much for
Another one is Tom Holland, and no, not the Spider-Man actor, the historian, has a book called Dominion, which treats of much the same topic.
Great. Call to Communion here on EWTN, handling your mailbag questions today. This one from Jamie in Oregon, who says, Dr. Anders and Tom, I've been researching Catholic saints. During this process, I have found there are steps to sainthood, such as servant of God, venerable, blessed, and then saint. So someone who is blessed may not be in heaven, but a saint is definitely there? This confuses me because I came across a person who is blessed and died in like the 15th century, but then we just had our first millennial saint canonized. How does the church make this decision? And is it okay to ask for the intercession of someone who is blessed but not yet a saint? And if someone is not a canonized saint, does that mean that they're not in heaven? Thank you,
right.
Jamie in Oregon.
You can seek the intercession of anyone that you have some reason to believe is in heaven. If they died with faith and in the grace of God and with heroic charity, and that's your own personal interaction with them leads you to that conviction, you can absolutely pray to that person.
Your grandfather.
My grandfather, my father. I mean, these guys are not canonized saints. I pray to them all the time, right? What you can't do is you can't give them a date in the church's calendar and have the bishop promote their public cult.
Right.
Right. But there's nothing stopping you from praying for them. And in fact, that's how people make it onto the calendar. So, you know, when there's a local character who made a great impression on the people around him or her for his or her sanctity, there is a cult that begins to venerate the memory of that particular holy individual, and then usually a push for the diocesan bishop to get involved to promote the person's sainthood, because they think it would be good for the universal church to know about this guy, right?
Yeah.
And we have a local character here in Birmingham, Father Coyle, Patrick Coyle.
Yes.
Who was martyred. He was absolutely martyred for his witness to the Catholic faith in the very earliest 20th century. He was always writing newspaper columns and articles and editorials countering some anti-Catholic slur in Birmingham, Alabama at the time, and there were lots of them. And he was kind of making himself obnoxious to the fundamentalist population because he kept articulately defending the Catholic faith. And his own bishop said to him, you know, you're going to get yourself killed, because this was Alabama, you know, around the turn of the century,
yeah.
And the Ku Klux Klan was still very active and so forth. And his attitude was, well, if I get myself killed, I get myself killed. And I'm going to defend the Catholic faith. And then he crossed a line when he performed a wedding between a Catholic man who was Puerto Rican and a girl who was not of Hispanic origin, who was the daughter of a Methodist minister. And so at that time, that was regarded as an interracial marriage as well as an interreligious marriage. And of course, she became Catholic. And the Methodist minister was incensed and went and shot Father Coyle dead in broad daylight in front of witnesses, and was subsequently acquitted of the crime of murder. And his defense basically was something along the lines of, well, wouldn't you have shot the blankety blank blank if he had done that to your daughter, you know? And the jury basically said, yeah, we would have shot him too. And so he was acquitted, right? I don't know that it'll go anywhere, but I mean, there's a fair number of people around here regard him as our own little local saint.
Oh, yeah.
He probably will never be canonized, but I mean, that's the sort of story that would generate enough interest for somebody to say, hey, this is more people ought to know about that. More people ought to know about that. And then it eventually becomes, you know, it takes off, and you have to promote the cause, and it is kind of costly and time consuming. Why does somebody like make it to blessed and stop? It's usually because the push for that person's canonization is not getting any traction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they haven't moved from that state from the 15th century, they're probably not going to. You know, there's probably not a big push to do it. Now, you know, in the 20th century, 21st century, Pope John Paul II really made a decision. It was a policy decision to promote the causes of lots of lay people because he wanted to show the world that sanctity is possible, right, for people in all walks of life. And so we had some saint inflation, right? But it was by design. It was deliberate, right?
Yeah.
And the question, if you're not canonized, are you not in heaven? No, heaven is mostly not canonized people, all of whom can be prayed for. But the canonized ones are the ones that have a public recognition by the church and are added to the liturgical calendar, get their own feast day, etc.
Yeah, Jamie in Oregon, thanks so much for your email. It is called a communion here on EWTN as we continue with our mailbag programs. We're coming up on the weekend, obviously. It's going to be, here in a couple of hours here. One of our great weekend programs is called Pro-Life Weekly. We bring that to you every Sunday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. You can stay informed and educated with the latest news and truth on abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the culture of death. Abigail Galvan is your hostess for that. Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio, the great EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Do check that out. Here's an email from Lenny, who says, for the Passover meal, would the Jewish people take the lamb into their house to sacrifice it, or would they sacrifice it outside and then cook it inside?
Yeah, so in Jewish law, you're supposed to sacrifice, make your sacrifices at the temple, right?
Uh-huh.
But I am not an expert on first century Seder practices. And in fact, I don't know that anybody really is, because we don't have contemporary descriptions of the ritual.
I see.
We have, I mean, the rabbinic descriptions of the ritual come from the Talmud, which is, you know, doesn't come to fruition until centuries later, and you have to kind of extrapolate backwards into the first century. So I think we're a little bit in the dark on the way everything happened in that.
Okay. Lenny, thanks for your email. We're going to stay with the Old Testament times for Freya, who says, in the Old Testament, they talk about the Holy of Holies in the temple and, in the Mass, the real presence. I thought God was everywhere. How can I understand him being everywhere, but more so in one place?
Yeah, thanks. So we need to talk about modes of God's presence. Modes of God's presence. By God's immensity, there is a Catholic doctrine of God that is about his immensity. Immensity is something more specific than ubiquity or omnipresence. Immensity means not only that God is everywhere, but that all of God is everywhere. And so there is not more of God in an elephant than in a mouse, right? All okay. of God is present to every particle of created reality. That's the doctrine of God's immensity. That is definitely a mode of God's presence.
Okay.
God is a trinity of persons. The second person of the trinity did not become incarnate in every human person, but assumed a singular human nature, namely that of Jesus, in the incarnation and his conception in the womb of the Blessed Virgin Mary, such that if one approaches the flesh of Christ, if Jesus walks down your street and you touch his hand, you can say, in truth, I just touched God's hand. God has a human hand. It's the hand of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't stop God from being present everywhere by his immensity, but in virtue of the incarnation, he's only present where the body and blood of Christ are present in that mode, right? Which is the mode of the hypostatic union. It's a different mode of presence. There's another mode of presence, which is the indwelling of the Blessed Trinity in the hearts of his faithful. Jesus says, if you love me and keep my commandments, my Father and I will come to you and make our dwelling within you. It's not a dwelling that everybody has. It's a dwelling for those who love him and keep his commandments. According to St. Thomas, this is the mode of presence whereby God is in us as the known is in the knower and the beloved is in the lover. It's a different mode of presence, right? And so God's presence with us by virtue of the consecrated host is specifically the presence of the humanity, the body and blood of Jesus, the body and blood of the historical person, Jesus, who now lives at the right hand of the Father in heaven. Now, by his divinity and his immensity, he's everywhere. But in virtue of his humanity, he's only where the body and blood of Christ are.
Freya, thank you so much for your email. We're going to stay in the Old Testament here for one more question, and this is from Stephen. So, Dr. Anders, why does the Old Testament canon differ in content depending on which codex it was? May have to unpack a couple of terms there.
Yeah. So a codex is a way of binding texts together. You know, up until about the second or third century, maybe later, if you wanted to read a book, you had to read it on scrolls.
Right.
Right. And but you know, the idea of like creating a binding along the back and then binding pages together that you could turn, like we do a modern book, and they, you know, be tied with leather or something, or maybe bound into wood.
Mm-hmm.
That construction is called a codex. That's a technological invention of like mid to late antiquity. Doesn't exist earlier. And so you have different codices of biblical texts, and it's not just. Yeah, but I think getting hung up on codex is the wrong idea. What you're getting at is that you have different canonical lists.
Yes.
Right. It doesn't matter how they're bound. Right. The fact is that there are different canonical lists. There are different canonical lists because ancient readers of sacred scripture didn't agree on the lists. Mm-hmm. There's no more. I mean, it's not more any profound than that. And some of that has to do with geography. Some of it has to do with theological disposition. So within the Old Testament canon, for example, I mean, you know, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Bible based on the larger canon, obviously is something that's more attractive to Greek-speaking Jews than to Hebrew-speaking Jews. After Christianity, which embraced the Septuagint as its canon of the Old Testament, there's a kind of conservative Jewish pushback to eliminate anything that hints of Christianity. And so there's a, you know, a kind of a rejection of the Septuagint and the Deuterocanonical texts and a doubling down on the Hebrew canon. Even the Hebrew canon isn't fixed, you know, until a later point in time. One of the interesting things about the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran is we find different versions of ancient Hebrew texts, different versions of Isaiah, for example, right? So there's not only is there not a fixed canon, there's not even a fixed text.
Wow.
Right? And so these things are fluid. You know, they're works in a process of evolution. And there's no way to just decide arbitrarily that the process of evolution stops at some point. You know, where are you going to draw the line and say, this is the version we're going to work with?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the only way you can do that in a non-arbitrary way is if there's someone who has authority to make that decision. And in Christian theology, Catholic theology, that's just the church's job, right? The church says, okay, boom, this is the version we're going to work with, right? Protestants don't have that. And so they're still canonical questions, and they're not real live for a lot of people, but they're academic, but they still exist in Protestantism. I remember when I was in seminary, I was taking a class with the celebrated professor of hermeneutics, Grant Osborne, and something came up about the long ending of Mark, because, you know, there's more than one version of Mark floating around the ancient world. And there's one with a longer version that includes part of chapter 16 that's not in the shorter version. And so most scholars think the shorter one is the original and the rest of it got added on later. And so somebody said, you know, what about the long ending of Mark? And I remember Dr. Osborne said, oh, well, it's not canonical. It's not inspired. Why not? Well, he says, well, Mark didn't write it. It wasn't part of the original text. Now, to make sense of that, you have to understand the evangelical doctrine of inspiration, evangelical, not Catholic,
yeah,
is that inspiration only pertains to the original autograph, meaning the document that first came forth from the hand of the apostle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a completely unworkable concept, because there is no first version, right? That's what history has shown, especially in the Old Testament. These are texts in a process of composition and evolution over time, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
There's no the version that Isaiah the prophet wrote, period, and then it stops when he picked the you know the pen off of the page. It doesn't work that way. The canonical version is the one the church accepts, no matter who wrote it,
mm-hmm.
right? No matter what process of composition went into it, what pieces were woven together, it's the version that the church has accepted as canonical that becomes the canonical version, but that requires belief in the authority of the church to make that determination.
Yes, indeed. Stephen, thanks so much for your email. We'll close with this one from Brian. What can one do when researching an issue and finding that two Orthodox moral theologians disagree on that issue? How can one find the correct view?
Well, you know, I don't know what the issue is. And sometimes the magisterium will intervene when there's an issue like that. Sometimes
uh-huh.
the magisterium will intervene. So John Paul II wrote Splendor Veritatis, which is the only encyclical in history, I think, specifically on moral theology, in part to address this problem.
Okay.
Because there were Catholic moral theologians that were taking positions that the Pope thought were incommensurate with Catholic Orthodox, and he wrote the encyclical to clear this up. So sometimes you'll find a definitive answer from the magisterium, and then you go with the magisterium. Sometimes you don't, and then you will probably conclude that this is an area where legitimate theological disagreement is allowed. Like if there's not a magisterial intervention to settle the matter,
uh-huh.
it probably means disagreement is allowed. And most moral decision-making is not of the highly theoretical kind, right? Most moral decision-making is, if you've ever heard of the trolley problem, you know, like trolley's going down the street, it can go left and kill one person or go right and kill three, and you've got the lever. If you pull the lever, it kills one person. If you don't pull the lever, it kills three. Do you actually pull the lever or not? I don't know anybody that's ever done that in real life. You know, I mean, so this is the kind of thing ethicists sit around and think about, but they really have very little purchase on actual daily life, right? Which is moral decision making is more like, you know, should I have that third beer or not and then get in the car? no, don't have the third beer, you know. And for that, for normal moral decision making, what is required is inspired prudence. You know, lived experience, some knowledge of the context and circumstances, listening to authorities that know more about the subject than you do, following good examples and so forth, and then following your conscience at the end of the day after you've made a good effort to inform it.
Brian, thanks so much for your email. Fast-moving program, I must say. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
And, David, I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Appreciate it. You too.
Hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. We're back at it on Monday here on EWTN's Call to Communion. If you'd like to listen to this show again, you can do it. Check out the recording at EWTN.com/listen. EWTN.com/listen. We'll see you in here on Monday. 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on EWTN. Until then, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Enjoy that weekend. That's an order. See you then on Monday's Call to Communion. God bless.